It was only months ago that nationalisation seemed to belong to the world of big band music, ration coupons and nylons. But that was before the government reluctantly nationalised Northern Rock, a move to rank with the great nationalisations of the 1940s or later of Rolls-Royce in 1971. Suddenly, a debate that seemed long dead is back with a vengeance. The government said it was the only effective response to the financial crisis, an act of practical pragmatism. Its critics accused it of returning to the bad old days of socialist state intervention from which Britain had been liberated by Mrs. Thatcher, for whom privatisation was as virtuous as nationalisation bad.
It used to be conventional wisdom that we couldn't denationalise any state-owned companies. Not anymore. Privatisation is popular. In the last year alone, we have denationalised Jaguar, Sealink and British Telecom, to name just a few. And there are more to come.
She unwound what the Attlee government had nationalised after the war, British Gas, BT, the electricity industry and so on, and her successors went on to privatise British Rail. The British left, though, are still not reconciled to what happened and cling to the old-time religion.
The richest country in the world per capita is Norway. Why? Because they nationalised all their oil. Richer than America. If you look, see what Chavez is doing in Venezuela, nationalised the oil and pouring the money into schools and health and so on. Look at Nigeria, where the oil is privately owned. Great wealth and corruption at the top and poverty among owners. Look at the Middle East, it's exactly the same. I think it's a question of your conception of what is good for society.
It is point, counterpoint, views that are passionately and sincerely held, but feel curiously from another age. The contemporary debate has moved on. Despite the Conservative Party's sound and fury, or Mr. Benn's counter-arguments, the majority of the British public certainly did not believe that the nationalisation of Northern Rock represented a return to socialism. Rather, it accepted the argument that a temporary period of public stewardship for the bank probably represented the best deal for the taxpayer while safeguarding the financial system. Vincent Cable, the Lib Dem shadow chancellor and hardly a tribune of the left, speaks for many.
I think in the particular case of Northern Rock, it was an entirely practical response to a particular situation. The government had advanced enormous amounts of money to this company, and it needed to be sure that it was going to get the money back and not be blackmailed by a couple of hedge funds.
But it's that same practicality that arguably was the reason you might have supported nationalisation in 1945.
Yes, and it's the same practicality that's led me to support privatisations in a certain context. I mean, certainly many of the privatisations of the 80s were in retrospect entirely sensible, and we'd never question them again. We know we really wouldn't want to nationalise British Airways or the steel industry. I mean, they're perfectly sensible. Why shouldn't these be traded internationally and treated like any other business? But there are practical circumstances where public ownership is a sensible response. Not just Northern Rock. I mean, we don't talk about it very much, but we have renationalised the railways infrastructure in recent years through Network Rail. Metronet has become a nationalised entity, at least through London Transport. When the contract collapsed, and there are circumstances in which it clearly is the obvious solution for the state to intervene.
In fact, historians have begun to ask whether nationalisation has not always been regarded more pragmatically than ideologically, even at its zenith in the 1940s. The arguments used to justify Northern Rock's nationalisation are far from new. After the devastation of war, the arguments for the state to step in were very similar, whatever the socialist rhetoric. Moreover, nationalisation was never quite the dismal failure that it was frequently portrayed to be. Professor David Stevenson of the London School of Economics.
The research that's been done by economic historians now has tended to rather rehabilitate the record of the nationalised industries, and the quantitative research that's been done looks, for example, at productivity growth in nationalised industries in the UK compared with productivity growth in the private sector, and also comparisons have been made with the US, where the utilities remained in private ownership. And that sort of work suggests that during the 50s and 60s, the growth in output per man was actually quite good in the British nationalised industries, and also they increased their profitability, their coverage of their costs by the 60s by comparison with the 50s.
We shall nationalise the mines, we shall nationalise the Bank of England, we shall nationalise steel, and we shall nationalise transport. Well, that was part of Labour's election programme a year ago. And today, we can all see this programme beginning to be carried out in practice. But it's all happening so fast.
A Home Service talk on nationalisation, broadcast in 1946.
It's just a few minutes before midnight, and in very soon, the signalman here will signal in the last Great Western Railway train to pass through Reading. Well, goodbye, Great Western Railway, now officially dead as far as this station is concerned.
Veteran industrial correspondent Geoffrey Goodman well remembers those days.
Well, we started off with Bank of England and the coal industry. That was the first real step in 1946-47. And then the coal industry vesting day was on January the 1st, 1947.
You are, from now onward, the custodian of the national interests as regards the provision of coal.
And from there we rolled into the electricity industry in the following year and British Rail in 1948.
And here's Inspector Mead just come into the box. So happy New Year to Inspector Mead. Do you feel any different now than you did a few moments ago when you were at Great Western Railway?
No, I don't think we do. Of course, we've done our best under the Great Western Company, and I hope that we should be able to serve the public under the nationalised railways as well as what we have under the Great Western. Happy New Year to all the travelling public and to the national railways.
Perhaps we could say a Happy New Year to your what? New owners, eh?
New owners, that's right, yes.
Happy New Year to you.
The National Health Service in July 1948, and gas in 1949, and then the following 2 years, iron and steel.
So who more accurately described the reasons for nationalisation? Thatcher, Venn, or Cable? On one extreme, a belief that companies are solely creatures of the individual and market. On the other, that they must be controlled by the people, for the people. The truth is more complex. No big company has ever been able to grow without in some way or another the support of the state. At its most simple, supplying an educated workforce, roads, or ensuring power. At its most complex, offering, like Mrs. Thatcher did for Vodafone, the wireless spectrum for their mobile telephone network for free. The question is the degree. Nationalisation is this inevitably necessary relationship between state and enterprise taken to an extreme degree in extreme circumstances, like a financial crisis or after a war. Tony Benn, though, goes further. Nationalisation is not an extreme response, it's the normal response.
We had meetings in troop ships. I was the Labour candidate in a troop ship coming home in the summer of 1945 from the Middle East. And what people said was this. They said we had mass unemployment in the 30s. We had fascism. We had the means test. We had rearmament. We had war. No unemployment now. If you can have full employment by killing Germans, why can't you have full employment by building hospitals, building schools, recruiting teachers, recruiting nurses? That's how we got the welfare state. And then when the government was elected, it was exciting, of course, very exciting. I campaigned in the 1945 election. They wouldn't let me vote because I was only 20, too young to vote. But the election victory came. But, of course, what I've learned now, as anyone does of my age, every generation has to fight the same battles again and again. There is no railway station called socialism if you catch a train driven by the right driver. Everybody has to fight it. And the power of capital against the power of the people is now more powerfully expressed than at any time in my life. And therefore people say we like control of our economy, we want schools, we want hospitals, we want homes, we want decent conditions. And the only way you can do it is by seeing that the power, the key power, rests with the voters and not with the wealthy. That's what it's about. That's not a surprising reaction. That's what people want.
My father was a captain in the Royal Artillery, and one of his jobs was to tell the troops about the Conservative prospectus, the Labour prospectus, and Liberal prospectus. And he always told me that the appetite of the troops at that time was very much similar to the one that you've described. You know, real desire to get rid of, not to repeat the 1930s, and a real sense that we, the working class, are masters now. It made it very legitimate, popularly legitimate, didn't it?
Yeah, but if 7,800 miners have been killed and 1,200,000 injured in the pits in 9 years, then you expect people to want something better.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't exactly based on reading Marx. It was the fact that we're in an industry that's dangerous, our wages have been cut, we've been treated like dogs, we want a share of the wealth of what we produce, you know. I mean, it's very straightforward, isn't it? Not very difficult to understand.
Workers at the time, like these mine workers in discussion with their management in 1949, were refreshingly unideological about nationalisation.
My point's this, about
fancy goods coming into miners' villages. Well, I'm all for it, as much as I can for all these things. Miners should have them as well as anybody. But we don't want differing from anybody else. That's the point.
No, I'm not arguing
we
for
segregation. We don't want to be that.
I'm not arguing for segregation, but let me come back to my point. What did you expect to get from nationalisation? Mitchell said that you expected cars. Well, so do I. In the present and in the future, in larger numbers, as the industry becomes more
prosperous. I expected a standard of life that included a car. A car represents a certain standard of life.
Yes.
And that's the standard of life that nationalisation should have brought to the miner.
Now, we can't bring it in 5 minutes. We've got to earn it, you see. We've got to get out of the industry. We can only get out of it what to bring to it and put into it. Well, we've got to get the money before we can share the money. That's the point.
Well, on this question of nationalisation, I'll tell you what I expected. We've got two teams now. Two separate teams, actually. But I found out this, that we got to be moulded together as a team, both management and men. Not two separate units, but we'd got to come together. And that's the only solution to the problem that I do see.
This is the voice of the times, giving the homecoming heroes both the jobs and sense of belonging they had not had in the 1930s. But that begs the question, why should so many non-socialist, middle-class professionals and government officials agree? The reason was they accepted that in extremis, after the war, private business was not up to the task of reconstruction, modernisation and renewal. The state had won the war, it would now win the peace, and nationalisation was the pragmatic mechanism. Geoffrey Goodman returned from the war aged 25 and observed what was happening at close quarters. I put it to him that the Attlee government's decision to run the nationalised industries as government departments betrayed socialist ambitions of popular control by the people. Rather, the object was increased investment and efficiency.
I absolutely agree with that, Will, because there were serious failures, of course, in the running of the managerial structure of the nationalised sector, partly because they were being operated by pioneers. We knew very little about how to run nationalised industries, even the coal industry, which was a sitting duck for public ownership. Very few people knew how to run it effectively. And when Manny Shimwell, famous story about this, when Manny Shimwell, who was then the cabinet minister responsible for nationalisation of the coal industry, when he went to the National Union of Mine Workers and said, look, have you got a plan to help us to run this industry? They said no. And the fact that it had been under debate for nearly 20 years shocked Shimwell. He said, well, surely you've got a plan. And Lawther said no. And Shimwell then said to Lawther, well, look, we're short of management to run the coal industry, 700 pits, 800,000 miners. We need managerial efficiency to run it. And he said to Lawther, will you, president of the National Union of Mine Workers, help us to run this industry? And Lawther said, no, that's not our job. My job is to ensure that mine workers get the best pay and conditions. You run the coal industry. Now, I think that was a fundamental error by the trade unions, but I can understand why people like Lawther were so narrow-minded in the concept, because nobody had been brought up to understand the nature and culture, social and economic problems of running the public sector.
It was the same story across the Channel in France. The French Communist Party urged nationalisation because it would put industry in the hands of the workers. But many others supported it because private business was both seen as inefficient and tarred with the brush of collaboration with the Nazis. Dr. Piers Ludlow of the London School of Economics.
There was a very widespread perception in the 1940s that a state could no longer afford to allow economic discontent and poor economic conditions to fester without being punished by the rise of extremist politics. The lesson of the 1930s was very clearly that if you allowed serious economic problems to go unaddressed, this would lead to not just further economic difficulties, but also political meltdown.
It's against this background that you've got a general case for government activism.
Yes, yes. If there is a problem, it is the state's duty to go and deal with it, and the state is the best actor to deal with it. There's, in a sense, no holding back.
Even the free market home of pure capitalism, the United States, indulged nationalisation. Many of the vital dollars given under the Marshall Plan to France, for example, went straight to support the newly nationalised industries. So why didn't Washington regard widespread European nationalisation as a worrying shift to the left? Because, as Professor David Stevenson of the LSE explains, it wasn't.
The Americans supposed that in 1946-47 they were facing a very serious economic crisis in Europe, and that if no action was taken, it would very likely have serious political repercussions, most likely that this key communist parties coming to power in key European countries and therefore assisting the spread of Soviet influence. Now, the Americans, of course, are not particularly in favour of nationalisation as a solution, but the Truman administration is in favour of state intervention and state activism, which in many ways is exactly what the Marshall Plan represents. It's an enormous injection of public American taxpayers-funded programme in the interests of European reconstruction and recovery. And what it's linked to and what the Americans hope it will achieve is a massive increase in productivity in Europe through selective investment in key sectors that are needed for modernization of the European economy, as well, of course, as pushing for things such as freer currencies and reduction of tariff barriers within Europe. So the American approach is slightly different, but they still start from the assumption that it's the government's job to act and take action and not revert back to interwar isolationism.
Professor Noel Whiteside of the University of Warwick agrees. French nationalisation may have gone further than even the British, but for her it represented the triumph of pragmatism over ideology.
But I don't think the French nationalisations were oriented towards the creation of a socialist state, far from it. I think the nationalised industries in France epitomise French dirigisme, which means that, you know, a bit of technical knowledge and a great deal of central authority can create a very high degree of efficiency, particularly when you have got national standards of technical qualification administered from Paris through every higher education institution in the country. This was a revival of older efforts to establish the French glory. And it does lead to what the French call the Trente Glorieuses, the 30 glorious years of growth and collective prosperity.
How extensive was it? How far did it go, this nationalisation programme?
It is much more extensive and much more pervasive, I think, than the British state. Renault becomes a nationalised industry and a substantial state holding in Citroën as well. They retain state control of their armaments firms. Gaz de France, Electricité de France are founded. SNCF and Air France have already been founded in the 1930s.
We're just arriving in Paris on Eurostar. The British fast-speed link completed some 15 years after the French. But if the French side is nationalised, it's hardly socialism or even a staging post on the way to the promised land. It's simply a more efficient and pragmatic way of running a railway, a case the British conceded when the public body Network Rail took over the management of the British rail infrastructure after the botched privatisation of the early 1990s. The more you look at it, the more nationalisation seems unideological and pragmatic, and privatisation ideological and often unrealistic.
Monsieur Atelier, just to start off, why did the French state limit its nationalisations in 1945, 1946 to coal, steel, railways and banks, insurance? And why did it not go further?
Well, that was a political agreement between the different parties in charge of the existence. That was the need to restructure and develop the sector of the basic industries.
Jacques Attali was François Mitterrand's special economic advisor in 1981 when the president determined to extend the nationalisation programme that de Gaulle had started. It was part of a wider state-led programme of mobilisation designed to boost investment, sold as much for its pragmatism as its socialism. It survived for less than 4 years. The world had moved on. It no longer understood nationalisation as necessary pragmatism, but as a taboo to be avoided, especially in a European community committed to liberalising markets. Attali has now moved on too, advising Gaullist Nicolas Sarkozy on how France should respond to the knowledge economy.
To what extent did you see nationalisation at that time as part of a, you know, socialist-communist programme, or to what extent was it pragmatic?
It was a pragmatic communist and socialist programme. That's my answer.
Is that in the tradition of French nationalisation? Is that the same tradition, do you think, that was there in the 1940s?
You cannot say tradition. I mean, tradition means centuries. That was twice.
In Britain, there's a reappraisal now of nationalisation. We're beginning to think that actually it was not as inefficient as some of the critics say.
I'm very proud of what we did in 1981. I think that was very efficient, very useful, but what was completely ideological was the privatization, which was sold at very cheap price. And recently we did, the French government did the same with highways, which were privatized at a very cheap price, purely on ideological reason. I think that what we did in 81 was a very good pragmatic reasons that save companies like Thomson or Saint-Gobain or almost all companies that we nationalized were saved and affluent when we they were sold, and now they almost all disappeared when privatized.
What was the reason for the success of French nationalization, do you think? I mean, it's regarded as comparatively successful. Why? What was it about the structure in which nationalization took place?
We are a nation where the state has always been strong, attracting the elites, engineers, administration, management, and therefore we had very good people to manage those companies. And the fact that they were mainly linked to public orders and to great programs such as railways or water or energy, then they were linked to what the government can decide as a supply. And therefore we had supply and demand in the same hands. That was quite an element of success.
Are they autonomous corporations in France, or are they departments of state?
Of course they are totally autonomous. They were totally autonomous. There are very strong personalities in charge of them.
Jacques Attali. French preoccupation with nationalisation after the war did not last long. State planning was soon felt to be a more effective means of driving French industry forwards while preserving the merits of private ownership. The architect was that great French pragmatist Jean Monnet, head of the government's first post-war commissariat du plan, who went on to become a founding father of the European Union.
Before this European community, the French faced the Germans, the Germans faced the British faced either both or one of them. And it was with force that they tried to find a solution to their problem. Now, if the same men have to discuss and accept, as they do, that the various nations are equal, then their psychology changes. And we are engaged in the process of a gradual transformation of the attitude of people from national to European.
To explore where nationalization kind of ends as an ideology and pragmatism in the name of economic efficiency begins, I've come to the house of Jean Monnet, architect of the French planning system immediately after the war, and then, of course, the architect of the post-war Europe and the European Union. With me, I have Arnaud Pinon, the director of the Jean Monnet Maison and project, indeed. Arnaud, there was this kind of spasm of nationalisation, wasn't there, in 1945, 1946, coal, steel, railways, but then it kind of tailed off, and it was the planning system that kind of drove the modernization. Is that a fair description of what happened?
Yeah, but I think there were not many more sectors to nationalize after the 45-46 period. This was strongly inspired by strongly inspired by the communists that were at that time in the government. And then Monnet used these sectors of the economy to help in the planification.
And by 1950, he succeeded sufficiently both to give the French confidence that actually their economy was on the move and they could start to deal with the Germans on a position of equality.
Yes, this was probably his biggest achievement, because we were only 5 years after the war, and so it was another time a very bold proposal he made to a French government that was convinced that they needed a bold solution to end up any risk of another terrible war between France and Germany.
And that gave us the European coal and steel community.
Yes, absolutely. The whole idea was to move on step by step and start with two sectors that were strategic for French economy, for German economy, for war economy, and that by putting in common coal and steel under the supervision of a supranational high authority, both the French and the Germans understood that it would be very difficult afterwards to go on to another war.
Desmond Dinan is a historian of the EU. In fact, he's the Jean Monnet professor at the George Mason University in Virginia. He agrees with Arnaud Pinon in Paris that the ECSC was an audacious attempt to make sure that the two countries' war-making capacity was taken out of national control and put into the hands of a supranational body. This act reconciled France to German reconstruction and so paved the way to today's EU. For Dinan, concerted state intervention in the economy was the necessary precondition for the success of the entire European enterprise.
Monnet then Europeanized that plan. It became known as the Schuman Plan, but nonetheless he was the architect of it, in the coal and steel community. So the European coal and steel community, to some extent, was the French economic plan writ large for the six. Government direction, planning, involvement, in this case not by a single national government, but by the six governments collectively, who transferred authority for doing so to the high authority of the coal and steel community.
So the ECSC was the bridge from the post-war world of nationalisation and planning to the world we recognise today. Large private multinationals, booming trade, head-spinning sums of money moving freely between countries, and of course financial crises like last month's on Wall Street. In a global world, private capital now rules, and if only Nye Bevan could have seen it, says Geoffrey Goodman, nationalisation had to be as multinational as private companies.
Nye, I don't think, for all his brilliance, had not yet actually come to understand and come to terms with the fact that this process was being internationalised, and that no good taking over the commanding heights in Britain. You have to think now, I'm not saying you should have thought of it then, but you have now to think of taking over or intervening in, influencing the commanding heights globally. And what was happening in Europe then was in fact the beginning of globalisation. And we now realise that, but we were a bit short on realising it in the earlier stages.
But I asked Vince Cable, is it globalisation or a shift of political attitudes that has made nationalisation so much less attractive in recent years?
I think the globalisation is more important. The reason for that is if you have a big, open, global, competitive market, there is a need for transparency, a need for people who are competing in international markets to know that there's not some political hand behind every investment decision. And there are a need for rules, international rules, which are more difficult to apply to government entities than they are to private enterprise. So I think it's inevitable that if you have genuinely globalised markets, you're going to have private players in it. But in some countries, that model won't fit. And at some times in history, that won't fit. And there are some industries where it doesn't fit. And we have to be open-minded about it.
But it's more even than that. States, companies and markets are inextricably connected. Neither the British government over Northern Rock, nor the American government over stricken American investment bank Bear Stearns hesitated to act, despite globalisation, just as European governments did in the extreme circumstances after the war. We've never really understood that argument or ourselves, and so ended up with the worst of both worlds. Nationalising, but not having the will to make it work. Nationalisation is dead. Long live nationalisation.